While national reporters will often swoop in and cover a local story once it's reached national significance, local reporters are there from the beginning. They know the players, and they know the communities. Today's guest knows Portland, Oregon as well as anybody, and she's been covering the protests and the violence there from the beginning. She's Noelle Crombie, this week on Story in the Public Square. Hello and welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Joining me as he does every week is my great friend and colleague, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, storytellers, journalists, novelists, and more, to make sense of the big stories shaping public life in the United States today. This week, we're joined by award-winning investigative journalist Noelle Crombie, from the Oregonian in Portland, Oregon. Noelle, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So, you know, I think we're taping this now at the end of July. In the last several weeks, the public's attention has been focused on events in Portland, but the story in Portland goes back more than a month, a couple of months now. Tell us what's going on in Portland.
Yeah, on Sunday, we had our 60th consecutive day of protests in downtown Portland. These demonstrations began in the immediate aftermath of the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis at the hands of police. Portland police have had their own issues with the killing of Black Oregonians, and I think the killing of Mr. Floyd brought those again to the fore. And really animated protests that we've seen here. They started out with thousands of Oregonians gathering on the east side of the Willamette River, and then marching across one of the city's iconic bridges into the downtown core and demanding reforms, police reforms.
Were these initial protests in the immediate aftermath of Mr. Floyd's murder, would you characterize them as peaceful? Were they violent protests? How would you characterize them?
They were peaceful. They were largely peaceful. And I was out there covering them along with my colleagues. And what we saw was really a groundswell of people showing up and making themselves heard. We saw a lot of young people of color on the front lines of these demonstrations, of these marches, leading them and giving speeches at the waterfront. In front of thousands of people who'd gathered there. I heard calls from those speakers for peaceful events. However, even early on, we saw spasms of violence toward the end of the night at these events. And that has come to mark these demonstrations straight through to last night.
So what is the source of the violence, or who is perpetrating the violence? Do you have a sense of that? I'm guessing it isn't any monolithic description here, but who are the perpetrators, as best you know? And what are they doing specifically in terms of violence?
Well, police have characterized the violent aspect of these demonstrations as being carried out by agitators, a criminal element. What we know is that it's a relatively small group among this larger group. And, you know, as to who they are, you know, we don't have a very clear sense of that. Portland is home to a robust protest culture that predates these events of the past 60 days. We've had the sort of far right and far left wing groups sort of doing street brawls here in the past few years. We've seen large Occupy demonstrations, May Day demonstrations, So the city has seen these large scale signs of sort of unrest over the years. This, it is hard to say, isolate who is carrying out the acts of violence. What we do know is that each night is ending with sort of fireworks being thrown at the U.S. District Courthouse in the center of downtown, fires at the being set in the portico of this building, lasers being shown at the in the direction of law enforcement, and just sort of an aggressive stance by some demonstrators, and that is met by with force by law enforcement.
So talk a little bit about the protest culture in Portland. For those of us who don't live there, I think that might be maybe not necessarily a surprise, but help us understand why Portland, Oregon would become a place where protests left, right, and whatever would take root.
Yeah, I mean, that is a complicated, unique to Portland situation. What we're seeing on the streets right now are clearly a large number of Black Lives Matter activists and their supporters. And we're seeing also civil libertarian activists. We're seeing people who are against Trump. They're coming out against Trump and federal overreach. But we also have a culture of Antifa here, anti-fascist activists who have a robust role in the city's protest culture. We also have anarchists as well, who are kind of regulars on that scene. As to whether those are the groups or factions that are driving the sort of late night disturbances, hard to say. And there's not really, there is an overreaching message of against police brutality and police reform. That is clear. But at the moment, that message has, as some have told me, has been sort of co-opted by the focus on the federal involvement here.
So let's talk for a moment about the federal involvement. When President Trump famously signed his executive order to protect federal buildings and federal monuments, is that the moment when federal police, federal law enforcement became involved in the protests in Portland?
There was a turning point. It's a very clear turning point about 2 weeks ago when.
So this would be, again, we're taping this at the end of July. So that would be mid-July that there was a turning point.
That's right. And it was a watershed moment here where federal officials, law enforcement officials made up of Department of Homeland Security and U.S. Marshals Service deputies were one of them fired on a 26-year-old Portland man who had his arms, video has shown him to have his arm over his head at the time. He was holding a boombox. It was playing a song whose themes were around equity and racial justice. And he did nothing, according to the videos that we have seen that have been widely circulated. He was doing nothing that was physically aggressive or particularly provocative. The video shows that this gentleman, Donovan LaBella, was fired on in the head. He was hit in the face with an impact munition. He crumpled to the ground. He continues to experience the effect of a pretty severe brain injury as a result. He was expected to be released from the hospital over the weekend. This inflamed the public, and it really animated these protests. Up until then, I'd say we had seen a dwindling presence out there. Still a nightly demonstration, but nowhere near what we saw in the early days. After Mr. LaBella was fired upon, and the president offered praise to federal law enforcement's response to Portland, and he did that maybe within 48 hours, that really elevated, it escalated what we're seeing on the streets. We saw thousands of people come into the streets now. People who, while perhaps were most certainly sympathetic to Black Lives Matter and the message around police reform, they're now animated by resistance to Trump and to the federal government's presence on the city streets.
So what are some of the other tactics that you and your colleagues have observed and written about in terms of federal law enforcement? I know you've done some video, your colleagues have, I've watched some of that. What else has happened? What else are they doing besides, well, obviously tear gas is involved, I guess pepper spray, but let's hear it from you.
Yeah, I mean, tear gas is a nightly, this has essentially been a nightly ritual. These events unfold almost on a script. So we've got a peaceful start to the evening, speakers, moms who have formed a wall out there. Veterans are now their own sort of block of protests. There are, calls for nonviolence and for Black Lives Matter. At some point in the evening, inevitably things will shift. The tone shifts. Fireworks are set at the Justice Center or at the federal courthouse, and police will emerge from the courthouse, and there's just a cloud of tear gas that's emerged. It coats the downtown core. It's hard to see. It's a cloud of gas that gets released night after night. We're seeing that. They also use impact munitions of various sorts. We still don't know exactly what Donovan LaBella was struck with. There has been estimates that it was or guesses that it was a beanbag round. Others have said it was a sponge tip munition. Colleagues have been hit with pepper balls. A colleague of mine was struck over the weekend in the back with an impact munition as well.
So if you could speak to the average, quote unquote, average resident of Portland or even Oregon who may not be participating in this, what is their reaction to watching all this? I mean, obviously more people are watching and reading about this than actually participating. Do you have any sense of, the vox populi?
I think people are deeply unsettled by what's unfolding downtown every night. And to be clear, I think, and this is the question I've gotten from my own relatives and friends in New England, to be clear, this is only taking place in a very small part of the downtown core. This is in front of the Mark O. Hatfield U.S. District Courthouse and the Justice Center, which is next door. The Justice Center houses the police bureau and the jail for the county. These are the buildings where this unfolds every night. You could walk a block away from them with your back turned and see a quiet, peaceful street. When I drive home after covering these events, the city streets are empty and deserted. It looks like, the middle of the night in any other city. So there's that to be aware of. This is really happening in a very small part of our downtown, but I think it's unsettling to most people. And I think there's a sense that perhaps the attention on the federal government's involvement here has taken away or overshadowed the message of reforming police.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me as he does every week in the co-host chair is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who is an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal and the author of 17 books. You can find Wayne on Twitter too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Noelle Crombie, an award-winning journalist with the Oregonian and Oregon Live. She's been documenting the protests and the violence in Portland and joins us from there to share the stories she's witnessed firsthand. You can follow Noelle on Twitter at Noelle Crombie. That's NoelleCrombie. I want to ask you to elaborate on that because you had a really beautifully reported story recently in the Oregonian that was reporting on the sense that this new phase in the protests is really overshadowing the Black Lives Matter movement. And you quote a speaker from one of the events, a Mr. Michael Richard, who said, and I'm quoting here, What's going on over there is a white movement that's taking over Black Lives Matter. Can you expand on that a little bit?
Yeah, I was covering the protests over the, during last week, and there were probably 2,000 people standing in front of the Justice Center, and the speakers were had spent hours, multiple speakers, all of them young people of color, addressing the crowd with this message of defunding police and Black Lives Matter. And then it was a very clear moment that sort of Act One was coming to a close, because next door at the courthouse, fireworks were being set. And that was a message for people to put on gas masks and to you know, be prepared for the law enforcement response. And for some of the people that I've spoken with, this is that's the narrative that will emerge from that night's protest. It will be drowned out. The message of reforming police will end up being drowned out, or at least the attention diverted from reforming the Portland Police Bureau, and it will now be focused on Donald Trump and his administration and the actions of federal agents in the streets. And I think it's a frustration for some of the activists that I've spoken with. They are eager to get back to that original message and to really stay focused on that message, and to hold city leaders and state lawmakers accountable for the demands, for executing the demands that these groups have made. And those demands include, you know, reforming police discipline, cutting police budgets for the Portland police, at least, and eliminating units like the school resource program or transit police or the gun violence reduction team, groups that units that some say have had a disproportionate effect on people of color in Portland.
So these are significant issues and demands. Is there any progress toward realizing those in Portland, the legitimate demands of the Black Lives Matter and the police protesters? You know, again, you mentioned that in some senses this has been overshadowed by the violence, but there's a real core issue here that is a fundamental issue. Where does that stand in terms of actually affecting, you know, the political change or the police change or both that is needed here?
I think it speaks to the impact of the demonstrations that amid a pandemic, the governor called for a special session to address issues of police reform. So that session is underway. And some of the reforms that have been debated and discussed and pushed for are now being talked about by lawmakers. We saw a very immediate response to the demonstrations in terms of leadership. The police chief, who was a white woman, she stepped down and made room for an African-American successor who was a veteran of the police bureau. The district attorney also stepped down much earlier than planned to make room for his reform-minded successor. And so you did see a swift response, and you did see cuts to the police bureau. The city council did impose some cuts. Activists say it wasn't enough. They want to see the police bureau, you know, fundamentally reshaped and reformed. The mayor has said he does not support defunding and eliminating the police department. So there are still things that are, you know, that are in play, but I would say they've had a pretty profound immediate effect.
So you are one of America's leading investigative reporters, and we're going to get into a little of your work. We don't have enough time to get into all of it toward the end here, I hope. But recently you've been covering this, what is happening politically, what's happening on the ground, what's happening with the protests. How has that been for you in terms of A, your work and the work that is your passion, not that this isn't a passion, but also, you know, in terms of home life and in terms of the stress? This is a very stressful environment, a work environment. You've got young children. How are you managing all of that?
It's a good question. And it's a balance that my colleagues and I have struggled with in recent months. It was all hands on deck for the pandemic, and now it's sort of all hands on deck for these demonstrations. And, you know, my daughters see me go out to cover these protests at night with a lot of gear, which includes, you know, a gas mask. And I came home the other night very, very late, and my youngest daughter was still waiting up for me in the very early hours of the morning because she was concerned. You know, it's this dominates the news cycle here. It is really topic A among Portlanders. It is hard to get away from, even though I went on a long walk in my neighborhood today, and it's a very peaceful and beautiful city. But it definitely is the story that journalists need to be bringing their focus and their skills and their attention to. There is no bigger story right now, and honestly, it's a privilege to be working on it.
Well, this is public service journalism of the highest order, you know, and you folks are doing it out there, and people around the country are doing it. And so, you know, great kudos to everyone who's doing that. There's no more important time for public service field journalism than now.
Amen.
And I think the broader struggle is news organizations themselves are struggling with resources and you know, the economic forces that have played out and devastated news organizations around the country. And you know, the Oregonian is no exception to the struggles that the industry has faced. And yet, you know, a lot of us have not taken time off and are working really long hours. And so it's sort of a vocation or calling, I guess.
Hey, Noel, I'm curious. There's a lot of rumor, misinformation and disinformation about who some of the players are in Portland. And one of the things that has been making the rounds in social media anyways is speculation. And I'm going to call it that and see if you can either pin it down or say, yeah, we don't know. But speculation that the federal forces in camouflage that are emerging from the federal buildings at night, you know, all Kevlar'd up, looking like they are ready for business, are really contractors from military contracting companies. Some people might less generously call them mercenaries. If any evidence that what you're seeing in the street is contracted employees of federal law enforcement?
You know, I've seen that rumor myself, and I don't know the extent to which it is true or not. I do know that the people who are on the streets representing the federal government are also made up of Marshal Service workers, some of them based here in Portland. So the extent to which there are contractors or, as you say, mercenaries, I really don't know. And I think that you know, it's obviously something that needs to be reported, but I can't say whether that's the case.
So let's segue here in the few minutes we have left to some of your earlier work. Tell us about Ghosts of Highway 20, one of your award-winning series, and also led to a documentary. So talk about that. What was that for those of us who may not know what the Ghosts was?
Gosh, and just thinking about that, it feels like it was many lifetimes ago.
And it was less than 2 years ago, right?
No, I know. The Ghost of Highway 20 was a five-part narrative that had a five-part documentary component, and it was an examination of one man's you know, criminal exploits in the Pacific Northwest on US 20. He was linked to crimes that had never really been explored or reported very deeply. And so I set about over the course of 2 years to examine more closely what links he had to the disappearance and assault and killings of young women along this sort of very wooded, isolated part of Oregon that winds from central Oregon to the coast. And in the course of that reporting, I was able to find a young woman who had been raped by this killer. His name was John Aykroyd. He was a state highway mechanic for the Department of Transportation. And he had raped her off of a secluded spur off of the highway in the late 70s. And she reported that crime and it was investigated and police took his word for that. And that really set him on a lethal trajectory. And her story had never been publicly told. She had never discussed it. And so she really became kind of the moral heart of this story.
So you've also produced a documentary. Was that a new storytelling form for you?
Yeah, early on, the editor of the Oregonian, Therese Bottomley, had this idea that, hey, why don't you team up with Dave Killen, who's an accomplished filmmaker and photographer on staff. And he's doing amazing work, by the way, on the demonstrations. And so Dave and I teamed up early on with a colleague, Beth Nakamura, who's also on the protest duty. Both of them, by the way, having been struck during the course and injured during the course of their reporting on the demonstrations. But we were sort of a team on the Ghosts of Highway 20. And, you know, Therese really wanted a very strong visual component. And so we worked together from the very start, and that really informed the way the project looks and feels. And we had so much rich material that we turned it into essentially episodes that are about 30 minutes in length.
What does that visual component do for you that you can't do with the printed word?
You know, it created a very immersive experience for readers, we're still seeing tremendous traffic to that documentary on YouTube. It really resonated with readers in ways that I think the print product just didn't. People really wanted to see and feel what it was like on this in this desolate part of Oregon, and the images and the photojournalism and the documentary really allowed people to experience this in a way that the print just simply doesn't. And we're talking about crimes that unfolded a long time ago. And so bringing that to life was essential. We're really kind of animating a story that took place a long time ago in a part of Oregon that people may drive on, but aren't super familiar with. And so it was really incumbent on us to infuse that with life and vitality, and the photojournalism really allowed us to do that.
Well, Noelle, it's a tremendous body of work. Thank you so much for sharing some of it with us today. Please be safe and please keep us informed. She's Noelle Crombie with The Oregonian. That's all the time we have this week for Story in the Public Square. If you want to know more, you can find us at pellcenter.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter. For G. Wayne Miller, I'm Jim Lutis, asking you to join us next time for more Story in the Public Square.